What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off. Ryan Selkis is the founder of Messari, an open data library and curation tool that helps researchers, investors, and regulators make sense of the crypto industry. We cover a lot in this conversation, including macro crypto trends, the importance of data transparency and disclosures, and how to go viral on Twitter. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope you find it as entertaining and informative as I did. This podcast is presented by Blockworks Group, the only blockchain event and media production company I trust. If you're an investor, lawyer, accountant, or entrepreneur and want to attend exclusive events and dinners, visit them at blockworksgroup.io. I promise you won't be disappointed. Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Before we get into this episode, I want to give a quick shout out to one of our sponsors. Soluna is a blockchain computing company powered by its own renewable energy. The team is planning to build a 900 megawatt facility on top of a 37,000 acre location in one of the best wind sites in the world in southern Morocco. You'll hear more from them later in this episode, but I'd love if you could go check out their website. You can find them at soluna.io. All right, guys, I've got Ryan here. We got a whole bunch of stuff to talk about. We're going to go real fast and furious, I think is how you say it, to get through it all. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. This is long overdue.
It is. We had it scheduled one time, and then you had like this really important event happen. You can get into that later if you want.
Which one?
Your second baby.
Oh yeah,
that was pretty important.
Yeah, I'd say that was a milestone.
All right.
So a lot of babies. The company's a baby. 2-year-old's a baby.
That's all.
The baby's
fair.
A baby. Yeah.
Background, real quick, for those that don't know.
Sure. So I started my career in venture capital. Got into Bitcoin in 2013. And really just started as an independent analyst accidentally, because when I bought Bitcoin, I'd been following it for a couple of years, but when I bought it in mid to late 2013, it was right after Fred Wilson and the Winklevoss twins had kind of come out. So, you know, became clear that this was not just going to be a tool for kiddie pornographers and terrorists and all that. And then it immediately went up 6 times in the course of just a few weeks.
You're a great investor for that.
Oh yeah.
Genius.
Well, I mean, if that happened last year, I would have been a crypto fund manager. But at that point, I was winding down my previous startup. So I came at this from the angle of, you know, buy, sell, hold. Like, how am I going to, should I sell this and just chalk it up as a win and then, you know, use that to cover rent? I ended up going down the rabbit hole on a long weekend I think it was like Halloween weekend of 2013, and decided I was just going to be all in on this. And it was really where I thought I might be able to spend the rest of my career. So I sold what every good finance professional should do. I sold my 401k and took the penalty. I used half of it to buy more, and then the other half used to pay rent.
You're going to love this. So there's a video that has never been made public. I'm not going to tell you who has it. But it's of me saying, if Bitcoin goes to $3,000, 401k is gone. I'm going all in.
Oh man!
So I'm putting that on the record now. If it happens,
I hope we don't. I hope we don't go. Part of me hopes that we do, and then the other part is it's very painful.
We'll see.
The 85%'s a lot. Yeah, but because that was 23rd. So okay.
So twice before
I get in right during the first bubble, and then broke the Mt. Gox story in short order because I was writing a daily email newsletter, much like how you really started to build your following. And I got to know most of the executives, and then for better or for worse with that story, you know, still maybe one of the biggest in the industry's history. Everybody knew who I was overnight, even though I was just this, you know, 28-year-old kid that, you know, really didn't know anything yet. Still don't. But one of the people that I got to know was Barry Silbert, joined DCG before it was DCG. He was the first hire, kind of a Skunk Works employee at Second Market, helped recruit the core team. We raised a large round of funding in the doldrums of 2015. And I was helping with seed investing, given my background. But
before you go on, I want to talk about this for a second. What was the general
pitch, right? So 2015,
the not DCG a lot of, pitch?
Just to recruit people, right? So there's not that many people who really know about crypto outside of, you know, a small subset of the population. It's not really being covered by CNBC.
It wasn't exactly like that because there were a lot of people that got hooked intellectually in 2013 during the run-up.
The second bubble, but
And then everything crashed and you know, there was a vicious correction. So a bunch of people washed out, but the people that like this happens stay. In every single bull and boom and bust cycle, like some people stay. At that point though, there were no business jobs, right? There was no way for you to do this full time and get paid to, you know, kind of scratch the crypto itch because the industry was just so much smaller and the only people that were getting jobs were the developers, right? And there were only a few funds, right? It was like us, Pantera, Blockchain Capital, you know, maybe a couple of others, but that was pretty much it. they're all small at the time too, right? Obviously now, you know, we hear about another $100 million fund every other week, it feels like, which is great, right? Because there's a lot more talent that's coming in that's fundable, but still it was much different. It was actually pretty easy to find people that were of like mind that were really, really excited about it. Meltem joined very, very shortly, you know, after me. And then Travis a few months after that. But you know, when I joined, I said, you know, I don't really want to just be cutting seed checks. I just started a company and it didn't work out, but I like to be on that side of the table. So as soon as we closed the fundraise, CoinDesk came up for sale. I was like, this is perfect because we were thinking about doing a large event. And, you know, I had this vision, okay, we could do like the Money 2020 for crypto. And CoinDesk had, you know, phenomenal beta run in the Consensus 2015 event. It was a single day event here in the Time Center. New York Times building right here in right out of Times Square. And, you know, we said, we'll buy the business, we'll restructure it, we'll bring the team over here to New York, and we'll use basically the CoinDesk brand almost like as our top of the marketing funnel for the events. And so between that and then the DCG network and all the portfolio companies we had, we were able to throw fuel on that fire and over the course of the next couple of years, you know, grow the events itself about 10x. And got the business to profitability and now they're off to the race. I mean, this year they're gonna have a monster year. So that was CoinDesk. Those guys are doing great. I think most of the team's still there, which is good. I took a sabbatical last summer after CoinDesk. And you know, just trying to think what I wanted to do next, started to go down the Ethereum rabbit hole. Is there a there for anything that's built on top of Ethereum, or is it all just like pyramid schemes and kind of get rich quickism? Which, you know, directionally was not an incorrect bet, but my, you know, through the process, I pretty quickly got excited about the potential, even if none of the assets themselves were super attractive at that point. It was just, you know, I made the comparison. Okay, Bitcoin was like the central bank of, you know, the new technological era, and Ether is the new investment bank because. It didn't take off because people were using it for distributed applications. It took off because it was becoming a reserve currency for ICOs. So the first thing that I tried to do is just understand the supply dynamics of some of these assets. And you'd go down the top 10 on CoinMarketCap and you couldn't figure out what the circulating supply was for, you know, these half billion or, you know, multi-billion dollar currencies that were in the top 10. I mean, even Ripple, you know, EOS and some of these other larger ones, you have no idea how much is actually held by third parties and how much is held by the founders and the companies.
Well, the thing that was so interesting, I forget what day it was, I think of last year when CoinMarketCap basically changed some of the data. Right. They just said, look, I can't remember if they said they were counting incorrectly or they used new data set or clean the data or whatever they did.
Yeah, that graph's in our pitch deck. And just the need for better data. And, you know, I'm actually very quick to defend CoinMarketCap because, you know, we've been, you know, in the thick of this for the last, you know, 14 months now, trying to figure out like how to produce better data for the industry. And we'll, you know, I'm sure go through the full Masari pitch. But it's not easy because there are no standards from the exchanges. They actually do a very good job.
I was going to argue that everyone still uses it, right?
That's the dirty little secret. Everybody uses CoinMarketCap, right? You know, luckily were able to wean ourselves off of that, you know, pretty quickly. I think we're still in process, but for like the long tail of assets, mm-hmm. you know, they're still the only game in town. So for some of the major assets, you know, it's a different story. And for some of the exchanges that actually have very clean documentation, but I mean, that's a big lift, what they've done. So, now there are others, us included, that are, you know, starting to put this together and, you know, hopefully up the standards, but it's going to take a lot of time and energy in between, you know, them and us and guys like Nomix and so on. I think, you know, better solutions are coming, which is good. But, you know, the kind of core thesis behind Messari was we had to actually usher in an era of transparency from the projects themselves, because so much of the really material data about these new assets, by definition, were only going to be known by these token sellers. Mm-hmm. Because of the reserves, because of the founders' rewards and the vesting schedules and you know, what restrictions they put on resale for any of their pre-ICO mm-hmm. investors. That's a lot of hidden inflation in the system. And we were trying to model that out, Dan McCardle, my co-founder, and I. And you know, I had written a couple blog posts on the subject, and he DMs me. We'd worked together previously. We funded one of his earlier companies at DCG. And he says, you got to check out this side project that I'm working on. And he sent me the link for On-Chain FX. And I think I called him like 15 minutes later after I looked at it. I was like, this is amazing. Like, we're going to start a company together. Like, we can do this, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, hey, that sounds fun. Tap the brakes. You want to get coffee? but the rest is history, right? So
little did he know.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, it was like same wavelength. What he had already put into code, you know, I was banging my head against the desk trying to mm-hmm. put in Excel. And I think the marriage really worked out, because On-Chain was the front end, but we both talked about it. And we said, the ethos of this industry is not going to just allow another Bloomberg, another walled garden of data to emerge. You're going to need some base data layer and some common standard that people can access. Mm-hmm. So we decided we were going to build an open data library at Messari and focus on disclosures from the projects themselves. And then, you know, on a more proprietary basis, we would do the Marcus data integrations and you know, actually spin up these nodes for the different networks and parse blockchain data. And then, you know, progressively over time, pull more and more proprietary info, but certain information like who's on the team,
yep.
what's your fucking website, like what's the circulating supply, like that's kind of table stakes for an industry even as nascent as crypto, right? You want to know that information, and that shouldn't be behind a paywall. That's like front of an S1.
I was just gonna say, markets. Most of the information that becomes public in the non-crypto world is through the S1s. Right. And so all mm-hmm. of the things you just described in terms of, you know, what's the cap structure? What are some of the lockups, right? Some of this hidden or harder to get information naturally comes public through disclosures the IPO process.
And this is tricky because, you know, the SEC obviously thinks everything is a security mm-hmm. and many of the processes, they did look like securities offerings in terms of like how they were sold. Okay. These tokens weren't useful when they were sold, blah, blah, blah. Obviously people were speculating like crazy. We don't think that we don't think that many of these tokens that we look at on a day-to-day basis structurally are securities. Like, we just don't agree with that, but there's existing precedent. And if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, walks like a duck, you know, the SEC is going to say it's a duck. But, you know, as we think about disclosures and how we can actually bring some common sense disclosures and transparency to these assets, let's start with the extreme. Who speaks on behalf of Bitcoin? Who speaks on behalf of Monero?
You're not followed on Twitter by the Bitcoin CEO. I've got like six of them following me.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, aside from those guys, of course. So the SEC has even said, right? Like, you know, yep. Ether probably not a security anymore, mm-hmm. which implies maybe it was central. So if that seed has already been planted, there's probably a continuum. Yep. One of the things that we're trying to do, because we do believe in the future of this ecosystem and many of the assets that haven't even emerged yet, but that will emerge, we're trying to make that path a little clearer. And if you think about the regulatory mandate that most securities regulators have, they just want to protect investors mm-hmm. and promote fair and efficient markets and ultimately, you know, facilitate healthy capital formation, all of which, you know, has been missing in crypto, but is starting to get a little bit more tightly wrapped.
Absolutely. It would be fair to say that Massari.
It's Italian.
Massari. Yeah. Look, you're going to like really confuse me now.
No, I just wanted to give you a hard time. Oh, but okay. It is Massari.
If you could see him sitting here saying this to me with his Starbucks cup, you would just be like, go home. But is it fair to say that the goal here is transparency of data, or is there some other way that you normally describe it?
Well, our mission is to promote transparency and smarter decision-making in the industry. Okay. And it's always been those two things, right? So on-chain FX was always this fundamentals-oriented investor tool. Mm-hmm. Massari was all about transparency because you need certain inputs to get the outputs that you want that are going to be like fundamentals, right? So we think about, okay, if we're going to be the one setting some of these data standards, how do you do that without some government or regulatory body or self-regulatory body that comes and has some type of enforcement teeth to make those rules?
Mm-hmm. What do you think the answer is?
Well, we're going to talk about token curated registries, I'm sure.
Let's talk about them right now.
Yeah. So I think you can use economic incentives.
And you're talking about the economic incentive can drive a
enforceable disclosures,
a collection of people to mm-hmm. all follow the same rules and actually have some sort of
We call it the crappy data chasm, right? So earlier this year, we launched Agora, which is our open library that we have 200 plus community analysts contributing crypto asset research into. That looks a lot like Crunchbase. The problem with Crunchbase is that the information is static. And that's fine for private markets mm-hmm. because any new venture investor is going to do their own due diligence in an ensuing round. In crypto, you have private market information asymmetries and public market liquidity. So you need events-driven disclosures, and you need to find a way to level the playing field. But there is no top-down regulator that can globally enforce these standards because these assets trade across borders, mm-hmm. right, by definition. So you're not going to have a global equivalent of the SEC, at least not one that really works. And self-regulatory bodies only work when they're actually sanctioned by a regulator, right? Mm-hmm. FINRA with the SEC, NFA for the CFTC, and those are like 80 and 40 years old, respectively, the regulators. So without that type of teeth, how can you actually herd cats and create some economic pressure on projects to abide by event-driven disclosures and some type of common standards so that the quality of the data that's in those libraries doesn't just degrade over time?
I don't think a lot of people know, when you say event-driven disclosures, describe what that means.
If you're selling off your token treasury, if a co-founder leaves, if there's an actual partnership that you're going to announce that is real and is not just, you know, marketing fluff, those are things that move markets. And it's very easy. And in fact, it probably happens all the time. People get tipped off mm-hmm. on any, you know, major announcement. And you see this, you know, it's very difficult to prevent insider trading. That's why, you know, Coinbase and they're trying to do things as close to the, you know, by the book as possible and trying to do things the right way. And even still, you'll see some of those assets, when they announce a new listing a few minutes before. It's not much. Like it's impressive how tight to the vest they've been able to keep it.
They've gotten much, much better.
They've gotten much, much better. But it's still, you still see like in the minutes, right? You see some action. So like, you know, how do you prevent that? So we're trying to get closer and closer to leveling the playing field. And how do you create one common data library where everybody would have access to that information at the same time? Mm-hmm. So we said, we're going to build this open source. We're going to build APIs that allow anybody to freely access this information, including maybe our direct competitors for some of the, you know, other, you know, SaaS solutions that we offer. And ultimately, we shouldn't even be governing this open source system. So one way that you might be able to create some urgency and consistency of disclosures would be to create a registry of provably transparent projects. And if you had them actually put up some financial stake and they broke the rules, then they could get booted off the registry, lose their stake, and, you know, in the long term, if you can actually bootstrap that credential and the market deems it as valuable and exchanges use it, banks use it as a seal of approval, that if you don't have we're not going to do business with you. Then it becomes something that's kind of really powerful. And because you actually have money locked up in the system, you can incentivize a third party validator set, like kind of like a big four accounting firm, but on a global scale, or even just incentivize whistleblowers. You now have a pool of financial incentives that would encourage people to do the work to make sure that projects are being legitimate and they're following the rules of the system.
If you and I have a project and we're interfacing with this and we've got the economic incentive that is staked, we do something nefarious and we lose that, we get booted out. Do you think that, because I think of it as kind of a carrot and a stick. And the stick, is it the incentive or the economic loss, or is it the ensuing reputational impact that comes from the economic loss?
Today, it's probably just the economic loss.
Okay.
Because if you can build a network effect around this and it hits scale, then it becomes reputational loss.
Got it. Because it's basically saying, I'm trying to think of like a comparison, but it's, you know.
Like delisting.
Yeah, delisting off a stock or if you're some sort of bad actor or something from raising capital or whatever. Got it. Okay. Where are you guys today? Right, in terms of what you've got built, you guys just launched the new website and stuff. So kind of walk us through the product offering as it is today, and then kind of let's just touch on how you see this evolving over time and what work you guys have ahead of you.
Sure. I've always been a firm believer that data without any type of context is useless. Narratives without any type of data is also equally useless. And we've got a lot of that in the industry on both sides, right?
So get off Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. I've been on diet Twitter, so I go on every once in a while, but I've been trying to limit my intake. I generally think that we're coming at this from three angles. So we've got curated news, research, analysis, very tightly synthesized and tagged and categorized so that it's easy to search. And it's easy to come up with a repository of information if you're trying to get smart on a person, a project, a company.
And so this is what I'll call third party or external media, right? So this is everything from the Bloomberg, the Block, all these different media outlets that are producing.
Aggregated, summarized, tagged, categorized.
And then you guys are doing proprietary research and also some summarized news yourself.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I'd say that like our newsletter is a synthesis of everything that we see on a daily basis. And it's also, primary marketing channel, right?
Yep. How do people find the newsletter? It's very good. It's one of the only ones I open every day.
It's right at, above the folds, top of the homepage, Massari.io.
It's Massari, by the way. That's how you pronounce it.
Yeah, it's very sophisticated. I wish I had an Italian. I'm not even I strike that for edit that out. That botched Italian accent impression.
All right, so you've got the
Massari
the Ferrari. News.
So, do you know where the name Massari comes from?
I do not.
This is fun. So the Massari.
Well, you just said Massari Ferrari, so if that's where it came from.
Well,
I'll be impressed.
It kind of plays off of the merchants of Venice. So the Venetian merchants were the ones that popularized double entry bookkeeping. Actually, it's fascinating because a Franciscan friar, Luca Pacioli, was the one that actually wrote down the Venetian playbook for accounting and popularized that. And he was able to popularize it in large part, and it stuck because for the longest time, merchants were not exactly the most revered professions, right? Money changers, et cetera. And he kind of changed that because he was able to convince people that clean books was not just good business, but kind of a moral imperative if you're going to trust the people that you're doing business with. And obviously, that is a big reason that we had a capitalist explosion in the, after the 14th century and the Renaissance.
That was a great marketing ploy by him to change the narrative there.
Oh, yeah. Phenomenal, right? And so that's what we're trying to do with crypto, right? But instead of double entry, we're talking about triple entry accounting using these public ledgers. How do you actually parse them? How do you build standards around them?
My favorite thing is the first time you say triple entry accounting to anybody in finance, they look at you like you've got two heads. Like, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
And then when they look into it, they're like, oh, that's actually pretty interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, maybe we wouldn't have had a financial crisis. Or maybe the next one will be so much worse. We don't know yet.
we'll get there in a second. All right. So let's go back to the product itself. So you've got the news summary analysis.
There's curated content and then quantitative data, which is markets data and blockchain data primarily, but also, other bits of information. So that's
how
primarily on-chain effects.
Okay. How do you get the quantitative data?
So if it's Marcus data, it's exchange integrations, okay. Pulling from their APIs. If it's blockchain data, we're spinning up our own nodes for all the major networks. And then, you know, parsing those data sets and, you know, throwing them into a database and running our own queries. And then, you know, over time, I think we want to add more and more data feeds. So, you know, there's a really interesting company called Hive that does Twitter rankings, but based on instead of like PageRank that Google has, it's kind of like PeopleRank. Mm-hmm. So they do the rankings not based on number of followers, but on who, you know, do you have really high quality followers? Yeah. And vice versa. And so like they've created this web. So something like that, if we're talking about people data, then, you know, we'd plug something like that in, hopefully. Yeah. And I think we want to continue to do that with you know, very high quality data feeds, mm-hmm. Whether it's ours or somebody else's.
The beauty of this is you're taking a hybrid approach. You can integrate or you can build it out yourself. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing, and
it's build or buy.
Is that you can, the default is you're going to build it yourself unless there's something that's better.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about
okay.
it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So you got qualitative data, quantitative data. What's the third?
And then there's this disclosures library, right? So it's the first party disclosures from the projects themselves. And we kind of put that into its own category because it's relatively static information. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't change too much, but as soon as we have it and we can, you know, consistently go back and you know, check against it, then, you know, we can build software around it that makes that ongoing disclosure headache go away long term.
So let's talk about this for a second, though. You and I have got a project. We kind of do everything we're supposed to do. We put the disclosures out there. They know who the founders are, what the supply is, what mm-hmm. the treasury is, you know, the whole nine yards. When we go to, let's say, sell some of the treasury, how does the product or other people in the ecosystem know that we sold some of the treasury if we don't report it?
You don't.
Okay, today.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the incentive.
So, one of the fields in our application is what are your treasury wallet addresses?
And then.
So we can just look directly at the blockchain.
And you periodically
check. You know, because we have these nodes mm-hmm. Spun up, we will just flag those wallets, and if funds move, then we, you know, would send a ping to the system and we could reach out directly to the project and say, hey, was this an internal transfer? Was this a distribution? Did you just do some type of business deal where you had to transfer this? Like, what, you know, help us tag and categorize
this. This is the fun part about this entire industry, right? Is what you basically
can and by the way, this is only from the project itself, or like whoever is making these attestations. So, you know, no one's speaking on behalf of the entire token supply, because once it's out. And that goes back to the comment I had about, you know, these assets existing on a continuum, right? Mm-hmm. Probably all start fully centralized and look a lot like a security. And that's why we have things like the SAFT. Long-term, fully decentralized. That's at least the goal.
Yep.
And so if we can help in that path, should there be any person, company, entity that files or you know, does any disclosures with us, once the treasury token supply is depleted or an entity no longer officially exists to mm-hmm. control the development roadmap? Probably not, right? And so you could have projects that no longer do any type of disclosures in Messari, not because they decided they were going to be opaque, but because they didn't have any stake. Like mm-hmm. who's to speak on behalf of Bitcoin, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's funny because what you're essentially doing is you're getting people to opt into a disclosure system when there is a low likelihood of nefarious activity, right? In the beginning, early, when there's more centralization, everyone's gung-ho about doing the right thing. They're probably mm-hmm. fundraising or just fundraise, right? Kind of all that stuff. And the longer or the farther you get away from that point in time, the more important it is actually that they already opted in. Right, because now you actually are able, you kind of got your hooks in, and so if they start to do things that maybe they actually wouldn't necessarily disclose,
yeah.
you can detect something happened, right, and kind of yeah. figure that stuff out.
I wouldn't frame it quite like we have our hooks in, right? Maybe this is just marketing speak, but no, seriously, I mean the projects that we're working with. So we're going to announce our first dozen or so the week of Consensus Invest here in a couple of weeks. They're all projects that are already pretty transparent by design. The issue is there is no single place to to host all that information. Mm-hmm. No one has represented that they would build an open source project out of something like this and truly make this freely accessible to anybody. Really very few companies have the cloud or the distribution channels to actually brute force something like this into existence. Mm-hmm. I'd say Binance, right? They do have real clout, because if you want your token traded on Binance and they tell you to do something, you know, how high do you need me to jump, CZ, right? Like that's real. The question is, do you want that owned by the largest exchange, or does that create an issue in terms of monopoly of information? And so I think our approach to make this completely open source is you know, it's going to work whether we do it or we do it, you know, with other partners and, you know, we can work on this together. It doesn't really matter to us because we're not making money on it. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to design the system that'll actually get this off the ground and ensure that, the industry can continue to exist and flourish and people don't go to jail.
Listen, I think people don't underestimate, or they don't understand yet how important the work you guys are doing is. And I think over time it's going to become more and more obvious to more people. So I'm cheering for you, but,
thanks, Pomp.
Yeah, of course. It's like the only nice thing I'll say.
I wouldn't say that.
I want to talk about a couple of more macro type things in crypto. One, you recently tweeted that, there's a, issue around Bitcoin with, fungibility. Mm-hmm. And you said that you're overweight Monero. Explain what you mean by all that and kind of how you think about it.
Dan, my co-founder, calls this the consensus contrarian portfolio, which is Bitcoin, ETH, Monero, and Zcash, right? Like basically all the true cryptocurrencies, if you want to play that card. You know, I've written about this a number of times over the course of, you know, many years. The thing that is, one of the things that's still kind of scary about Bitcoin is, they're not private, right? So with enough forensics, you can trace most actors in the system. Mm-hmm. And that's good for catching bad guys. That's not great for censorship resistance. And we already see kind of anecdotally some of this behavior play out where, you know, large institutional buyers, like in the past, have gone directly to the exchanges and said, give us Virgin coins. And they'll pay a premium because they don't want to have to deal with all the coin taint. Who's actually owned it, right? Has this flown through Iran or someone on the OFAC sanctions list? So if you kind of zoom out, if this asset class continues to grow and grow and grow, one of the things that is a threat when people use crypto, even though we say, oh, if you don't hold your keys, like it's not your keys, not your crypto, most people are going to use a third-party service, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the other dirty little secret in the industry. Everybody knows don't hold your crypto on exchange, but so many people do, except for like the stuff that you really sock away.
This may be really controversial, but I actually...
But basically, if that's the system,
yep.
You have two types of coins, right? And so they're not perfectly fungible, which is why I made the statement about Monero. I there's definitely a lot of developers that are talking about this, but none of the companies really are. And to actually pull off incorporating something like confidential transactions, mm-hmm. or Mimblewimble or any of these, you know, cloaking features, you're going to need a broad community consensus. And some of the regulated entities might just say, I don't know if we can do that, mm-hmm. because that puts us in a pretty bad place. We can't use Chainalysis. We can't use Elliptic now. And we can't, you know, represent to regulators that we're surveilling, you know, potentially suspicious transactions.
So I'll buy that the regulated entities are not going to be ecstatic about doing it. But at some point, if you've got Virgin coins and non-Virgin coins, and you get the Virgin coins into the hands of some party, over time, the number of Virgin coins is going to decline until eventually it could be zero, right? And you end up with all non-Virgin coins because they've all been transacted. Is it something where you think at that point it's just there's one bucket of coins and it's all non-Virgin coins? Or do you think that there's like a good actor, you know, where you can actually trace, hey, these are all good actors in a KYC, to AML, you know, et cetera. And then there's the we don't know bucket.
I think the issue is just with enough forensics, you can basically say these are blacklisted, these are whitelisted, right?
Mm-hmm. You think that there could, like, let's take Bitcoin, for example, there mm-hmm. could be a separation of good Bitcoins and bad Bitcoins, for, you know, for lack of better terminology. Some people will definitely avoid the bad Bitcoins.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people were talking about this back in 2013, mm-hmm. You know, earlier. Right. But you know, certainly when I first got in, how do you actually, should you be able to track,
these coins? Because I mean, US dollars, right? What's mm-hmm. that 70-80% of US dollars have traces of cocaine on it. Right. So if you could label a physical US dollar as good or bad, you know, how much of the money supply would be affected and put into the bad category?
Yeah. Right. I always hear that stat and it's fascinating, and I always use it. I think everybody uses it. I feel like it's one of those things that someone just made up and then a bunch of people said it and then it just happened.
I've looked. Here's the fascinating
part. Is it really true?
So I've always used the 80% number, and yeah. I look, maybe this is probably 6 months ago. The number has actually been decreasing, which I did not expect. Yeah. Right. Because you would think, oh, the longer period of time, you know, the bills are in circulation, so actually it has a higher probability, whatever.
Everyone's just doing heroin now.
Jesus. I'm not even going there. All right. So the other thing I want to talk about is this idea of influence in crypto, right? And so there's a couple of different ways it gets applied. There's like the Twitter influence, which is just how many followers do you have, who are they, and can you get them rallied up to go do something, right? Mm-hmm. Or excited about something, whatever. Then there's like the hash wars type influence, where can you actually get people with computing power to go your way when there's contentious hard forks, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there is what I'll consider logo influence, right? Which basically means if you're an investor and your logo is on something, that must mean it's legitimate. If you're a news source and you wrote it, it must be legitimate, right? All that kind of stuff. Those are three very different types of influence. But in crypto specifically, the impact of exercising that influence is unlike any other industry, in my opinion, right? So if you look at, if you can get on Twitter a bunch of verified accounts to tweet about a project, the odds that it becomes legitimate in the mm-hmm. eyes of people is really important. And I'll use a direct example. So Tron, mm-hmm. there's a person who leads a project with a verified account. All of a sudden they start tweeting about it. There's a lot of people who immediately put more credence to what the verified account is saying about that project than, let's say, maybe another project that has no verified account as the creator of the project. Mm-hmm. How do we deal with that? Right? Because what you're doing is you're going after transparency of information. But
you're talking about reputation scoring, which is just a you know, a mathematical way to do what we already do, which is assess brand quality and trustworthiness.
But I think that with the reputation scoring, you've got to get to...
I will agree that you can move markets much, much faster in crypto, at least for now.
Yeah. Okay.
With you know, things like just having a brand and using some of those social cues. But I would argue that part of the reason that's true is because there isn't really good data in general, and there certainly aren't good data aggregation or information aggregation platforms.
And it's hard for the counter narrative to fight back.
Well, right? Yeah, because we live in an era of fake news, and everybody, you know, you know, everybody's opinion seems equal on the internet, right? So I don't think reputation systems are inherently bad. Like we use those heuristics all the time, like the verified, not verified. You know, this kind of goes back to the token curator registry example. You know, you want to be on a list versus off. You know, we're very good at making lists. I like, I always say that I like the token curator registry primitive, because lists are probably the one thing in this industry as an application that's older than money. Right, like it's hardwired in our DNA to be able to make, like, okay, this is the list of plants you shouldn't eat. Like this is the census of the village. If you don't recognize this person, then he's here to kill you. Right? Like we're good at those, and then you know that you know that there's intrinsic value to having certain information, and you know that you have a limit on how much information you can handle. So you need those heuristics. So the question is, how do we get better at actually doing reputation scoring, and how do we make sure that people don't get duped by a bunch of fake accounts from an army that's, you know, trying to you know, create a new world currency? I'm not going to name any names. You're smiling ear to ear. Don't make me do it.
what I'm actually thinking is, You know, we're talking about the reputation, and verified accounts is the easiest thing, I think, because it's on a list of verified accounts or it's not, right? But where I think it becomes really interesting and potentially dangerous, depending on how it's used, is you know, we just sat and watched the Bitcoin Cash, like the fork of the fork, I think you guys called it, right? And it's like half popularity contest of like, I mean, literally like high school politics type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's half like a bunch of technologists sitting around, like really trying to figure out what's better, what's not, how's this going to work, etc. And those two things clash so violently in these hard forks, and they're led by people, and it's all about influence. I mean, it is literally, I believe this person over that person. And I was thinking about it the other day. It's like
we're also at the stage where that can happen because no one uses crypto. It's all funny
okay,
money.
Okay, explain this.
It's all game right now. It's all funny money.
Agreed. Like
there's no fundamentals. There's no underpinnings. No one uses even Bitcoin for transactions. That's probably the one exception. Like, yes, some people are using Bitcoin in Venezuela, in, you know, dark markets, right?
Yep.
Like, okay, that's a single currency, and still 99% of that currency is just based on wild speculation. So, mm-hmm. Of course, narratives are going to move the markets.
We've now started to say holding is a form of usage.
Yeah, that's how bad it is, right? Yeah. And it's not entirely inaccurate, right? Because you got to shore up the monetary base, right? Like this is, you know,
I actually believe theory. That like there is
need
an
reservation demand.
Yeah, otherwise, there's an argument there.
And this is the problem with all the payment tokens. And this is how you knew that most of them were going to go down 99.99% until they get all the way to zero. Well, you can't do that really with crypto. But basically, these payment tokens are completely worthless because there's no reservation demand. If you need to actually use a payment token to access a service, you'll only hold it for as long as you need to use the service, which is normally a split second. Mm-hmm. And then you're out, right? So if you're just converting in and out, and you don't have any reason to hold any working capital, then it's all funny money, right? And as long as people aren't using Bitcoin Cash or even Bitcoin or Ether and go down the list, then you're going to have a bunch of people that got paper wealthy, ridiculously wealthy from this asset class. They're going to be able to throw their weight around and make wildly outlandish decisions about how to spend their money, and the game theory gets all thrown off because these people have, you know, more money than they know what to do with, and it's now just about egos. Mm-hmm. I think the worst part about what we saw the last couple of days, I can't imagine the SEC approving an ETF this year. I can't.
No way.
It's not. It's just you watch, like, you just, again, not going to name names. Everybody can look it up, but you just watch those principles like going back and forth. It's fucking embarrassing. And this is a multi-billion dollar asset.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if that's the current state of things, then, you know, we've still got quite a ways until you can actually put this in your 401k reliably.
Opinion when it comes to ETF,
it's dangerous, so it should be a little bit harder to access, I guess, is my general thinking.
I don't think the ETF even goes like Q1. Like I could see the ETF being like another year away, right? So we're in, you know, just started Q4. Yeah. Like it could be much farther than people think.
The only argument I think for the ETF is people. If you're going to drink here, if you're going to drink, do it here. We'll take your keys, right? So, you know, I guess that's not a bad argument,
mm-hmm.
right? People are going to speculate with these assets. Would you rather do it in a regulated, more secure vehicle that's got some rules in place? That makes sense.
Fair.
And that's the argument for BACT and Fidelity and you know,
yep.
all these other big legitimate institutions that are getting into the space.
The other thing I could see happen that, and this goes to the 3K Bitcoin price, I could see an ETF getting approved, let's say Q1, and then we go down 50%. Right? So basically the big moment everyone expects, if an ETF gets approved, then we're going to be off to the races and price is going to recover. If for some reason the ETF gets approved and it doesn't do that, then what happens?
I mean, I don't do price predictions, really. I'm really bad at it.
Forget price predictions. Yeah. What I'm talking about is...
Sorry, maybe I missed the back half of your question because...
We just had microphone issues.
The mic was collapsing.
And Ryan just
I thought I was having a seizure because it was just like slow motion.
I think we got that on video. That was perfect. he looked at me like he did something wrong.
I'm talking too hard.
So the ETF gets approved. Everyone thinks that's going to be a catalyst for price increase. Forget where it goes,
sure. Right?
But just increase. Mm-hmm. If an ETF actually gets approved and then there's not a price increase, we go sideways or down, mm-hmm. I think those are the types of moments that really drive the capitulation and just like, mm-hmm. like people sure. psychologically don't know what to do in that situation because there's been so much time and built-in yep. expectation around that moment, right?
Yeah, just because the ETF gets approved doesn't mean all the institutions start buying.
Absolutely.
And you know, that's the surprising thing. I think people were surprised that there wasn't more of a move on some of the news from like ICE.
Is Fidelity backed.
Yep. ICE is interested. Fidelity, you know, as a service. And there's going to be more announcements like that. And the question is, you know, is anybody going to actually step up and start buying? And if you just look at this from a momentum perspective, until the next rally starts, it's tough to see those institutions just piling in. None of the major institutional money managers are going to try to catch a falling knife in a market where it's personality driven, as we just discussed.
I think there's a ton of funds that are shutting down. We're in November right now. December, by Q2 of 2019, I think a larger number than we expect of funds start shutting down because of the high water mark issue. Right, so basically they monetized in
sure.
December 2017. They don't understand the economics. 18 is going to happen, right? December 18, they're not going to make the money they thought they were going to make. And then all of a sudden they're like, why am I doing this? It's going to take me another 18, 24 months to come back. They're going to start shutting funds down. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it could prolong bear market and all stuff. Before we wrap up, I got two more questions for you. Then you could ask me one, which scares the hell out of me. But you wrote this blog post about how people can get into crypto.
Mm-hmm.
Explain your logic as to what people should do if they want to learn, get involved, etc.
Well, I was getting a lot of inquiries on, you know, this is in the peak, right? December, January, and all hell was breaking loose. So I started to get just bombarded on Twitter and LinkedIn and you know, a bunch of, and like good intentions, you know, not, hey, how do I make a quick buck? Like people saying, I'm really fascinated by this. How do I break into the industry? And I just wanted to put my thoughts on paper so I could just fire off a link. And so I wrote this blog post, The Apprentice Crypto, and it had a slant where I figured, hey, if this works, I'm just going to put this out there. Maybe we'll get, you know, a handful of volunteer analysts that will help us populate some of this research in our open data library. And in it, I said, you know, I get these questions all the time. How do you break in? You know, my answer is write about this industry every day for 2 years for free. And then you'll, you know, probably have a few good ideas that stick during that time period, which is what I did. And, you know, it's kind of what you did. It's what Nick Carter has done. It's what Chris Berniski has done. Kyle Samani. Like if you think about like some of the non-engineers that have broken in mm-hmm. and just had an insane trajectory in terms of how quickly they were able to build their networks and followings. Because the market is so wide open and, you know, you're judged purely on the quality of your ideas and mm-hmm. kind of consistency. That's probably the best way to stand out. And that's the good part of Twitter, right? So, you know, leading into my question, when are you going to write the social media playbook for crypto people? Or are you really, really deathly afraid of losing all of your
Listen,
secret sauce?
I've actually tweeted. People think that I'm not open to telling them.
Actually, you I do remember that. Yeah.
I tweeted and I said, listen, yeah. This is how you win at Twitter. And I made a list and it was point by point. This is what you do. And here's the two things that are really interesting. So one is, there's just some people who are better at writing than others, right? And so if you writing is not just what words you use, but how do you construct thoughts and kind of you know, layer in and refer back and do all this kind of stuff. So some people are really good at that. Some people are horrible at it. I think that your idea of just writing makes people better no matter where they are on the spectrum. But Twitter specifically, there's this quote that Naval had it. He was like, you know, most blog posts should just be tweets.
Mm-hmm.
And so literally when I first started like taking Twitter seriously, it was, I have all these thoughts of like, oh, I should write something about X.
Yes.
and I would never write it.
Just distill it to 280? 280.
Well, this is back in 140. This is back in 140.
I love 280 like right out of the gates. So I was like, you can actually write a full sentence.
Here's the secret. When 280 came out, I was like, game on.
Yeah.
We could put spaces.
Drop everything.
We could put bullet points, spaces.
Oh, yeah.
So, all right. So emojis. We'll talk about, all right, let's talk about whoa real quick.
Okay. And I do have a 1A because we were just joking about this before, but my 1A would be, what tweet do you regret the most?
Oh, okay. I actually know which one it is. But the whole thing around Twitter is that blog posts, you actually have to have enough substance in order for people to understand what you're saying. You have to have a point, and you got to kind of hammer it home to make it valuable. Sometimes you don't have all of that. On Twitter, you can actually say something that people find interesting, not because you hammer home a point, but because you made them think about something, right? And so you have more leeway, and people kind of interpret things different ways, etc. The second thing is, if you can show people you're excited, they get excited. They might not even know what you're talking about. And so there's been a couple of times I've tweeted, all capital letters, W-H-O-A, right at the beginning of the tweet. And I go down to another paragraph and I type whatever it is. And it says, whoa. And people, whoa, oh, okay. And so it's become this running joke now that I've got a couple of friends who, they're like, I tweet whoa and there's no whoa in the engagement. But the tweet that I probably regret the most, and it's not, I don't regret it because I said it. I regret it because I actually didn't write a blog post. So this is one of the flip sides of, normally I like the fact that I just tweeted it, didn't write the blog post. This is one where I wish I'd written the blog post.
Yeah.
It's when I use the terminology around Bitcoin terrorist.
Yes.
And here's why.
That was when you took the break. Was it pretty soon after that? Sorry.
It was right around.
Tell the story.
Right, yeah. So I'd come out and I'd said, listen, if tokenized securities work the way that I envision them working, tokenized securities will be more disruptive on a global basis than Bitcoin itself. And the entire argument was predicated on the fact that if Bitcoin was to completely replace all money, right, so actual fiat currencies, gold and silver, it's like $90 trillion or something, right? Global real estate alone is $215 trillion. So on just a pure dollar basis, changing real estate and completely ripping it out and having this new infrastructure is more impactful than money. Now, the Bitcoin maximalists came out of the woodwork, right? This was like the most blasphemous thing they'd ever heard. And so both in private Telegram groups and on Twitter, all of a sudden what you got was the propaganda machine.
Yeah.
Right? And I actually think most of them have super legitimate arguments. I tend to agree with many of the points that they said now that I've spent more time with them and they've kind of explained it, etc. What just sent me over the edge was I would say something, some simple sentence, and they would then later on in the thread refer back to what I said with a little twist, right? And I was like, whoa, I didn't say that. And I'd go screenshot, right? And I'd get in the whole thing. And you're like, this is what terrorism's like. It's propaganda machine, and you basically bully people and you threaten and all stuff, right? Now, that's a word that everyone knows. Look, I am.
It's a little loaded.
I'm prone to the hyperbole, right? But this is bad, actually, right? If we all act like this, it is going to scare away the people who don't understand that, you know, the attrition of ideas and stuff is a good thing, right? It's going to scare away the masses. And so that's one where I wish I had really taken the time to write out, hey, here's what happened. Here's why it's important. Here's why I'm using this terminology, and here's what we need to do differently about it. Now, the funny part about that is most of the people who are offended, I've now become friends with, and they've kind of come a little to the center of thought. I've come a little to the center of the thought.
Are you not friends with anybody?
I'm friends with everybody.
I'm saying that is a good thing. Yeah.
The best part about
it's tough to meet you in Twitter? Person. It's tough to meet you in person and not be like, I kind of want to have a beer with Pomp.
Well, I just think that
that's why so many people like coming on the podcast.
If you're positive,
yeah,
other people, no matter how much they hate, how much they have negative connotations, all stuff, you can kill people with kindness.
I believe that. I need to get better at that. I just have way too many battle scars. So I have too much snark in my blood.
You'll love this. Ready? This is my girlfriend's going to listen to this and she's going to roll her eyes and might go to the back of her head. Right. Mm-hmm. I texted her one day and I said, I hope you're having a great day. And she literally responded, LOL, that's what you tell the trolls on Twitter. I was like, I've gotten myself into position.
Did you just copy paste it from like a tweet?
I did
it. That would have made it so much better if you accidentally had like the at somebody else and sent that whole thing just as like a copy paste job. That would have been good.
I was like, are you kidding me? I've now gotten myself in a position where I can't say that without her thinking that I'm trolling her.
Look, man, you gotta have too much of a good thing, I guess.
Listen, I'm long positivity, short everything else. So amen. We're good to go.
Well, makes it fun for your guests too.
Yeah. Look, thank you so much for coming. People have to go watch the video because when the microphone fell, that was pretty epic. We'll get a couple screenshots and hopefully make a meme out of that at some point. All right. Thanks.
I just felt like I had to do that then.
He just did the finger guns at the video. So
it's been a long week.
I appreciate it.
I'm awful.
All right. We'll do this again soon.
On that note, maybe there will be a part two.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, Pom.
All right, guys, we're back here with John Belizaire, the CEO of Soluna. Again, you can find them at soluna.io. So, John, why exactly are you guys choosing to mine Bitcoin with your renewable energy sources?
Well, first of all, I get that question a lot, especially talking to renewable energy investors, why Bitcoin on a great energy site like this? And the thing that I always say is, well, you may not know this, but Bitcoin is a multi-billion dollar industry. In fact, every year, $5 billion of revenue is generated from mining that currency alone, and they only represent about 50% of the whole market. And on top of that, if you look at the ecosystem around that, billions of dollars is generated in profit through the sale of ancillary and supporting technologies to the industry. So it's a real ecosystem that just so happens to need unlimited and low cost energy, and that energy should be renewable. So that's one way I answer the question. The second way I answer the question is I get them to think differently about a typical renewable energy project. Most renewable energy projects, you have to find a great site, which in our case, we just so happen to have. Then you have to connect that resource to the grid and find someone to buy that energy. So we're talking about 900 megawatts of power. You can't just put 900 megawatts of power to the grid. But let's say you did. In the traditional sense, governments would pay you very large feed-in tariffs, the rate that they pay you for putting that energy online, or support you with a number of subsidies, for example. Well, that's kind of come out of favor in the world right now, generally because governments are somewhat bankrupt, if you will, and so they can't support that. And that's put a huge depression on the profitability of a traditional renewable energy project. What we're saying is, what if you could combine everything you normally do? So you can build an energy site, put that to the grid, sell it through a host of different commercial off-takers that would buy the energy, but also combine it with a co-located, vertically integrated computing center that would always also generate revenue. What that does for you is, number one, you can start generating revenue from day one, so you don't have to wait until you find that grid off-taker, if you will. But then you can use the grid to sort of offset the volatility of cryptocurrency. The net result is you have a much more successful, potentially way more profitable energy infrastructure project. So those two answers together kind of form the basis for Soluna's business model and also drives the opportunity to build something pretty unique in the whole blockchain ecosystem space.
Got it. No, it makes complete sense. Thank you so much. And again, guys, you can check them out at soluna.io.
Hey, everyone. Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.